Chapter 2. Off the coast of Somalia, 4 months later. The Indian Ocean was a shimmering jewel, perfectly clear and blue. But on its surface was a flaw in the shape of a 560-foot freighter. The ship was barely making headway, though her single stack belched copious amounts of noxious black smoke. It was clear the vessel was plying the sea lanes far beyond her intended lifespan. She was so low in the water that she had been forced on a circuitous route from Mumbai to avoid any storms because seas much above 4 feet would wash across her deck. Her port side would ship water in smaller swells because she had a slight list to that side. The hull was painted a scabrous green with patches of other colors where the crew would run out of the primary shade. Tongues of scaly rust ran from her scuppers, and large metal plates had been welded to her sides to shore up structural deficiencies. The tramp freighter's superstructure was just aft of amidships, giving her 3 cargo holds on her foredeck and 2 aft. The 3 cranes towering over the decks were heavily rusted and their cables frayed. The decks themselves were littered with leaky barrels, broken machinery, and clutter. Where pieces of her railing had rusted away, the crew had hung lengths of chain. To the men studying her from a nearby fishing boat, the freighter didn't appear promising, but they were in no position to ignore the opportunity she presented. The Somali captain was a wiry, hatchet-faced man missing a tooth in the center of his mouth. The other teeth around the gap were badly rotted, and his gums were black with decay. He conferred with the 3 other men on the crowded bridge before plucking a hand mic from the 2-way transceiver and thumbing the button.
"Ahoy, nearby freighter."
His English was heavily accented, but passable. A moment later, a voice burst over the tinny speaker.
"Is this the fishing boat off my port beam?"
"Yes. We are in need of doctor," the captain said. 4 of my men are very sick. Do you have?"
"One of our crew was a Navy medic. What are their symptoms?"
"I do not know this word, symptoms."
"How are they sick?" the radio operator on the freighter asked. "They throw up bad for days. Bad food, I think." "Okay, I think we can handle that. Come abeam of us just ahead of the superstructure. We will slow as much as we can, but we won't be able to stop completely. Do you understand?"
"Yes, yes, I understand. You no stop, he's okay."
He shot a wolfish grin at his comrades, saying in his native tongue, "They believe me. They're not going to stop, probably because the engines wouldn't refire, but that isn't a problem. Abdi, take the helm. Put us alongside near the superstructure and match their speed."
"Yes, Hakim."
"Let's get on deck," the captain said to the other 2. They met up with 4 men who had been in the cabin below the wheelhouse. These men had ragged blankets draped over their thin shoulders and moved as if crippled with cramps. The freighter dwarfed the 60-foot fishing boat, though with her so low in the water, the ship's rail wasn't that far above their own. Crewmen had hung truck tires for fenders and retracted a section of railing near the superstructure to make it easier to transfer the stricken men aboard. Hakim counted 4 of them. 1, a short Asian man, wore a uniform shirt with black epaulets. Another was a large African or Caribbean islander, and the other 2, he wasn't sure.
"Are you the captain?" Hakim called to the officer.
"Yes, Captain Kwan."
"Thank you for doing this. My men are very sick, but we must stay at sea to catch fish."
"It is my duty," Kwan said rather haughtily. "Your boat will have to stay close by while we treat your men. We are headed to the Suez Canal and can't detour to take them ashore."
"That is not a problem," Hakim said with an oily smile as he handed up a line.
The African crewman secured it to a rail stanchion.
"Okay, let's have them," Kwan said.
Hakim helped one of his men step onto their boat's railing. The gap between the 2 vessels was less than a foot, and in these calm seas there was little chance of his slipping. The 2 of them stepped up and across to the freighter's deck and moved aside for 2 more at their heels. It was when the 4th jumped nimbly onto his ship The Captain Quan became wary. As he opened his mouth to question the seriousness of their condition, the four men with the blankets let them drop away. Concealed underneath were AK-47s with the wooden butts crudely cut off. Aziz and Malik, the two other crewmen from the fishing boat, grabbed matching weapons from a wooden chest and rushed aboard. "Pirates!" Quan yelled, and had the muzzle of one weapon rammed into his stomach. He dropped to his knees, clutching his abdomen. Hakim pulled an automatic pistol from behind his back while the other armed men hustled the freighter's crew away from the rail and out of sight of anyone who may have been on the bridge wing high overhead. The Somali leader dragged the captain to his feet, pressing the barrel of his pistol into Quan's neck. "Do as you are told, and no one will be hurt." There was a momentary spark of defiance behind Quan's eyes, something he couldn't suppress, but it was fleeting, and the pirate hadn't noticed. He nodded awkwardly. "You will take us to the radio room," Hakim continued. "You will make an announcement to your crew that they are to go to the mess hall. Everyone must be there. If we find anyone walking around the ship, he will be killed." While he was talking, his men were cuffing the stunned crew with plastic zip ties. They used three on the muscle-bound black man just in case. While Aziz and Malik took charge of the other crewmen, Quan led Hakim and the four sick pirates into the superstructure, a pistol pressed to his spine. The interior of the ship was only a few degrees cooler than outside, thanks to a barely functioning air conditioning system. The halls and passageways looked as if they hadn't been cleaned since the freighter had slipped down the ways. The linoleum flooring was cracked and peeling, and dust bunnies the size of jackrabbits lurked in every corner. It took less than a minute to climb up to the bridge, where a helmsman stood behind the large wooden wheel and another officer was hunched over a chart table littered with plates of congealing food and a chart so old and faded it could have depicted the coastline of Pangaea. The windows were nearly opaque with rimed salt.
"How'd it go with the fishermen?"
the officer asked without looking up. His voice had an odd British inflection that wasn't quite right. He lifted his head and blanched. His big, innocent eyes went wide. The four pirates had the entire room covered with their assault rifles, and the captain's head was bent sideways with the pressure of the pistol jammed into his neck. "No heroics," Quan said. "They promised not to harm anyone if we just follow their orders. Open a ship-wide channel, please, Mr. Merriweather."
"Aye, Captain."
Moving deliberately, the young officer, Dwayne Merriweather, reached for the intercom button located next to the ship's radio. He handed the microphone to his captain. Hakim screwed the pistol deeper into Quan's neck.
"If you give any warning, I will kill you now, and my men will slaughter your crew."
"You have my word," Quan said tightly. He keyed the mic, and his voice echoed from loudspeakers placed all over the vessel. "This is the captain speaking. There is a mandatory meeting in the mess hall for all crew members immediately. On-duty engineering staff are not exempt."
"That is enough," Hakim snapped,
and took away the microphone.
"Abdul, take the wheel."
He waved his pistol at Merriweather and the helmsman.
"You two, over next to the captain."
"You can't leave just one man at the helm," Quan protested.
"This is not the first ship we have taken."
"No, I suppose it isn't." With no discernible government, Somalia was ruled by rival warlords, some of whom had turned to piracy to fund their armies. The waters of this Horn of Africa country were some of the most dangerous in the world. Ships were attacked on an almost daily basis, and while the United States and other nations maintained a naval presence in the region, the seas were simply too vast to protect every ship that steamed along the coast. Pirates usually used fast speedboats and mostly robbed the ships of any cash or valuables. But what started out as simple larceny had expanded. Now entire ships were being hijacked, their cargoes sold on the black market, and their crews either abandoned in lifeboats, held for ransom to the vessel's owners, or killed outright. So too had the sizes of the targeted ships increased along with the savagery of the attacks. Where once only small coastal freighters were the primary targets, the pirates now preyed on tankers and container ships, and had once raked a cruise liner with automatic fire for 15 minutes. Recently, a new warlord had started putting a stranglehold on other pirates along the north coast, consolidating his power base until every pirate in the region was loyal to him alone. His name was Mohammed Didi, and he'd been a fighter in the capital, Mogadishu, during the chaotic days of the mid-1990s, when the United Nations was trying to stave off epidemic starvation in the drought-ridden country. He had secured a name for himself plundering trucks loaded with emergency food and supplies, but it was during the Black Hawk Down incident that he cemented his reputation. He had led the charge against an American position and destroyed a Humvee with an RPG. He had then dragged the bodies from the burning wreckage and hacked them to pieces with a machete. After the inglorious withdrawal of the U.S. Marine Corps, Didi continued to build his power base until he was one of only a handful of warlords controlling the country. Then, in 1998, he had been linked to the Al-Qaeda bombings of the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. He had given the bombers safe haven for the weeks leading up to the attack, as well as several men to act as lookouts. With an indictment at the World Court in The Hague and a $500,000 price on his head, Didi knew it was only a matter of time before one of his rivals would try to collect on the bounty. He moved his operation out of Mogadishu and into an area of coastal swamps 300 miles to the north. Before his arrival, most victims of piracy were set free immediately. It was Didi who had initiated the ransom demands. And if they were not met, or the negotiations seemed to be faltering, he unceremoniously had the crews killed. It was rumored that he wore a necklace of teeth with gold fillings extracted from the men he had personally murdered. It was to Didi that the pirates taking control of the old freighter had pledged their oath. Hakim and one of his men forced Captain Kwan to take them to his office, while the other pirates escorted the bridge staff to the mess hall. Kwan's office was attached to his cabin one deck below the pilot house. The rooms were Spartan but clean, with just a couple of tacky velvet clown paintings on the otherwise bare metal walls. There was a framed photograph of Kwan and a woman, most likely his wife, on the empty desk. Brassy light blazed through the single porthole. "Show me crew manifest," Hakim demanded. There was a small safe bolted to the deck in the corner of the office behind Kwan's desk. The captain stooped over it and began to work the combination. "You will step back when you open the door," the pirate ordered. Kwan glanced over his shoulder. "I assure you, we have no weapons." But he did as he was told. He swung open the door and took a step back from the safe. With his assistant covering Kwan with his AK, Hakim bent over the safe, pulling out files and folders and dumping everything on the captain's desk. He made a sound when he opened one particularly thick envelope and discovered bundles of cash in several currencies. He fanned a wad of $100 bills under his beaky nose, inhaling as if testing a fine wine. "How much you have?"
$12,000, maybe a bit less.
Hakim stuffed the envelope into his shirt. He rifled through the papers until he found the crew's manifest. He couldn't read his native Somali, let alone English, but he recognized the various passports. There were 22 in all. He checked them, pulling out Kwan's, Dwayne Merriweather's, and that of the helmsman. He also found the passports belonging to the three men who had been on deck when they had boarded the ship. He was pleased. They had already accounted for a quarter of the crew.
"Now take us to the mess hall."
When they arrived, the brightly lit room was packed with men. A few smoked cigarettes, so the air was as thick as smog, but it masked the stench of nervous sweat. There were a mix of races, and even without the weapons pointing at them, they were a dour lot. These were down-on-their-luck men who could find no better employment than aboard a broken-down old tramp freighter. They had maintained her well beyond her years for the simple reason that they would never find another after she was gone. One of Kwan's people held a bloody rag to the back of his head. He had obviously said or done something to set off one of the hijackers. What's going on, Captain? Asked the chief engineer. His jumpsuit was streaked with grease. What does it look like? We've been boarded by pirates. Silence! Hakim roared. He went through the stacks of passports he'd brought from Kwan's office, comparing the photographs to the men seated around the mess until he was certain every member of the crew was accounted for. He had once made the mistake of trusting a captain about his ship's complement, only to find that there had been two others who had beaten one of Hakim's men to death and almost managed to radio a mayday before they were discovered.
Very good. No one is playing hero.
He set aside the passports and looked around the room. He was an excellent judge of fear and liked what he saw. He sent one of his men out to the deck to cast off their fishing boat with orders for Abdi to make for their base as quickly as he could with the news they had captured the freighter.
My name is Hakim, and this ship is now mine. If you follow my orders, you will not be killed. Any attempt to escape and you will be shot and your body fed to the sharks. Those are the two things you must remember at all times.
My men will follow orders, Kwan said resignedly. We'll do whatever you say. We all want to see our families again.
That is very wise, Captain. With your help, I will contact the ship's owners to negotiate your release.
Bastards won't spring for a gallon of paint, the engineer muttered to a table companion. Fat luck they'll pay to save our hides. Two of the gunmen had been in the kitchen gathering up anything that could be used as a weapon. They emerged dragging a linen bag full of forks, steak knives, kitchen knives, and cleavers. One gunman remained in the mess while the other continued to haul the bag out into the hallway, where it would most likely be thrown over the side.
These guys know what they're doing, Duane whispered to the ship's radio operator. I would have gone for a knife as soon as their guard was down.
Meriwether hadn't realized one of the pirates was directly behind him. The Kalashnikov crashed down on the back of his neck hard enough to drive his face into the formica-topped table. When he straightened, blood dripped from a nostril.
Talk again, and you will die, Hakim said.
And from the tone of his voice, it was clearly the last warning.
I see there is a bathroom attached to the mess hall, so you will all remain here. There is only one way in or out of this room, and it will be barred from the outside and guarded at all times.
He switched to Somali and said to his men, Let's go see what they are carrying for cargo. They filed out of the mess and secured the door with heavy-duty wire wrapped around the handle and tied to a handrail on the opposite wall of the passageway. Hakim ordered one of his men to stay outside the door while he and the others systematically searched the vessel. Given the ship's large external dimensions, the interior spaces were remarkably cramped and the holds smaller than expected. The aft holds were blocked by rows of shipping containers so tightly packed that not even the skinniest pirate could squeeze by. They would have to wait until they reached harbor and the containers were unloaded before they would know what was inside them. What they discovered in the forward three holds made whatever was in the containers superfluous. Amid the crates of machine parts, Indian-made car engines, and table-sized slabs of steel plate, they found six pickup trucks. When mounted with machine guns, the vehicles were known as technicals and were a favored weapons platform across Africa. There was another larger truck, but it looked so dilapidated it probably didn't run. The ship was also carrying pallets of wheat in bags stenciled with the name of a world charity, but the greatest prize were hundreds of drums of ammonium nitrate. Used primarily as a potent fertilizer, the nitrate compound, when mixed with diesel fuel, became a powerful explosive. There was enough in the hold to level half of Mogadishu, if that's what Mohammed Didi wanted to do with it. Hakim knew that Didi's exile into the swamps wasn't permanent. He always talked about returning to the capital and taking on the other warlords in a final confrontation. This massive amount of explosives would surely give him the edge over the others. In a month or less, Hakim was sure Didi would be the ruler of all of Somalia, and he was just as sure that his reward for taking the freighter would be greater than anything he could imagine. He now wished he hadn't sent Abdi ahead so quickly, but there was nothing he could do about it. Their little radio couldn't pick up anything beyond a couple of miles, and the fishing boat was already out of range. He returned to the bridge to enjoy the Cuban cigar he had pilfered from the captain's cabin. The sun was sinking fast over the horizon, turning the great ocean into a sheet of burnished bronze. Dusk's beauty was lost on men like Hakim and his band of pirates. They existed on an ugly, cruel level where everything was judged based on what it could do for them. Some would argue that they were the product of their war-ravished country, that they never stood a chance against the brutality of their upbringing. The truth was that the vast majority of Somalia's population had never fired a gun in their lives, and the men who aligned themselves with a warlord like Didi did it because they enjoyed the power it gave them over others, like the crew of this ship. He liked seeing the captain's head bowed in defeat. He liked the fear he saw in the sailor's eyes. He had found a picture of the captain and a woman in the office, the captain's wife, he assumed. Hakim had the power to make that woman a widow. For him, there was no greater rush in the world. Aziz and Malik entered the bridge. They had helped themselves to some new clothes from the officers' quarters. Aziz, only 25 but a veteran of a dozen hijackings, was so slender that he'd had to cut extra holes in the belt to keep his new jeans up around his waist. Malik was in his 40s and had fought at Mohammed Didi's side against the United Nations and the Americans. Shrapnel from a street fight with a rival gang had left the right side of his face in ruin, and the blow had affected his mind. He rarely spoke, and when he did, little of what he said made sense. But he followed orders to the letter, which was all Hakim demanded of him. "Go get the captain. I want to talk to him about the company that owns this ship. I want to know how much he thinks they will be willing to pay." He studied Aziz's eyes. "And lay off the bang." He used the African nickname for marijuana. The two pirates descended the stairs to the main deck. With the sun setting, the interior of the ship was gloomy. There were only a few functioning lamps, so shadows clung to the ceilings and walls like moss. Aziz nodded to the guard to untie the wire. He and Malik had their weapons at the ready when the door creaked inward. All three men gaped. The mess hall was empty.